Radio City, John Grayson and Rob Ross with you once again as we podcast our asses off. Rob Ross, what's going on in New York?
Not too much. I'm happy to say I already took care of the flu shot. Got that done yesterday, so I'm set for the season. It's been a beautiful couple of days, cool and comfortable. After a midweek full of torrential downpours and of course, the weathercasters being completely inept. You're going out to one day with a jacket and you're carrying it everywhere because it's like 110 degrees with the humidity.
Right.
You know, and then you schlep an umbrella everywhere and it doesn't rain. So, but no, nothing much going on in New York. It's actually been a fairly quiet week, save for the brouhaha up at the UN earlier last week with our beloved president.
Yeah.
Doing his stand-up routine.
Right. And, you know, the greatest thing about that is that if anybody had the impression that he somehow garnered some kind of respect around the world, that he wasn't making the country an absolute laughing stock in every possible way, those kinds of thoughts were exploded this week when they actually laughed at him. When he said, I've done more than any... He was the standard Trump bullshit. I've done more than any other president in American history. And they all started laughing. And he was surprised.
Well, he thought that he'd gotten a very favorable response, you see. So when they tried to explain it to him, he was filled with disbelief. Is that diplomatically put?
I think so. But yeah, either way, he's a schmuck and everybody knows he's a schmuck, which, by the way, was solidified late in the week. And I know we're going to talk more about what happened during the confirmation hearings for Kavanaugh, which still are not over yet. And now we've got a week's worth of FBI investigation to do with all of this. But, you know, it was solidified when he turned to the one agency that he's been trashing and referring to as the most corrupt in the country. And I think he even called them a cancer on the United States at one point, speaking, of course, about the FBI. So now who is he calling on to investigate his own candidate? The FBI.
The FBI. I was going to say maybe the CIA, because he doesn't know the difference between the two.
Right.
But, you know, let's kind of talk about this in broad strokes. I mean, the Kavanaugh hearing was just a dog and pony show of the worst kind, because
yep.
I personally bristle watching people, and I don't care what side of the political fence you're on, but I don't like seeing people being dragged through the mud in a public forum. If you're going to do this, you know what? Do it without the cameras. Do it without the hoopla, the brouhaha. You're there to do a job. It's not the court of public opinion. This is a serious, serious thing, vetting and seeing if a candidate for a Supreme Court position, or actually for any position within the framework of the federal government of the United States, is qualified.
Right.
No one has bothered to do it in a professional and, dare I say, adult manner since probably the 60s or 70s. You know, because I remember the whole Clarence Thomas Anita Hill thing. You know, and then the search for members of the Clinton cabinet and the public hearings and roastings that they got, you know, it just fuels a fire that's already burning out of control, because people on both sides of the political spectrum have gone just batshit crazy over the last few days.
Right.
It's impardonable and insufferable and tedious. And I have to tell you, I think this may have been my breaking point for social media. The only time I will, in fact, I don't know, indulge myself, if you will, on social media, specifically Facebook, is when I have to post something that has to do with writings on MusicTap or Popdos, or posting the podcast so that it gets out there to our friends and fans. Otherwise, I want nothing to do with any kind of conversations on Facebook. I can't listen to it anymore. I think it reached yet another crescendo of ludicrousness this morning when I woke up to find people screaming blue murder that Saturday Night Live is now an enemy to them.
Okay. I can't wait to hear why.
Apparently, Ariana Grande was booked as the musical guest. She canceled kind of late.
Now, right? She's, of course, engaged to Pete Davidson.
Right. So they called, quote, an old friend of the show who said, sure, I'll be happy to help, Kanye West.
Okay.
Kanye West, as a thank you, got three songs, which you okay?
Almost never happens, right? It's usually two and then done.
Unless you're, you know, Paul McCartney or U2 or Bruce Springsteen or Pearl Jam, you know, then you get three songs.
Well, even when Jagger, hosted / whatever, did musical guesting last year, he still got two songs. That was it.
But at least he had Jeff Beck come out.
So that's true.
But Kanye West came out wearing a MAGA hat.
Uh-huh.
And apparently he did a whole thing saying that the Democratic Party is what's tearing black people apart. You know, and basically using black folks. And now the general populace is screaming about how it's Saturday Night Live's fault that they validated Donald Trump by A, letting him host the show a couple of seasons ago, and by doing the Trump skits every week. I rest my case.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. Everybody knows that Kanye West is a dumbass, okay? I mean, maybe he's good at music. I have no idea. From the performances, all three of them that I saw on Saturday Night Live last night, I was less than impressed with any of it. None of it spoke to me at all. But I guess I'm not his target audience anyway. If you ask how many 49-year-old white guys are in Kanye West concerts, it's probably a pretty small number. So that's fine, but I don't care about that. And if I'm going to stand up and salute when somebody who is a musical guest or a host on Saturday Night Live says something that I agree with, then I have to be able to say, yeah, well, let Kanye West spout off on whatever the hell he wants to do. I've always said people should be able to say whatever the hell they want to say. And if you have a microphone and if you have a TV camera pointed at you, you take advantage of it. You take your shot. And if it's going to be good for somebody I agree with, it's got to be good for somebody I don't.
It's just the way that people are going about doing this. They're getting worse and worse. It's this infantilism that's just raging out of control. It is a collective hissy fit.
Right. It's, I can't hear that. I can't let my ears hear those words. Oh, grow the fuck up.
that's what it boils down to. You know, I'm sorry. I've reached that point of just such disgust for people that I know and have respected and cared about, but I can't listen to their bullshit anymore.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden you're starting to look at me with a raised eyebrow of suspicion because I happen to be a white male, heterosexual, because, you know, I was never great in the boyfriend category, so now I'm no different than any other man. First of all, how many years ago was all that?
Oh, yeah, right. Well, let's talk about this, though, for a second, Rob, because I'm not sure you and I can be friends anymore. Pending your answer to this question, do you like beer?
You know, I used to love beer, but the older I've gotten, the more it makes me pee. So the answer is I refrain from beer. My bladder can't take it. So therefore, I've had this conversation several times as of late, which is why, you know, and the same thing is I don't drink hard alcohol because – you can drink it and enjoy it, but it's going to punch you in the face when you're not looking. You
right.
know, I love Grey Goose with cranberry and lime. I can drink several of them with ease.
Sure.
But what happens afterwards is not going to be
good for anybody.
It's not going to be beneficial to me. So my answer is my preference is wine because I know when to stop. Wine is heavier. It has a quicker impact. And once I feel the wine buzz, I'm good.
Yeah.
You know? So do we maintain our relationship?
I think we're good. I think we're fine. it is. Everything has gotten to that level where it's any little thing can just shut off a friendship. And that is such insanity. Now, of course, neither of us is ever going to do that. But that's the point is that I hear it all the time. And I've been used to this in talk radio since 1992, which was only 3 years after I got into the business, when Rush Limbaugh really started to take off. And I'm not going to blame him. It's not his fault. It's the idiots who listen to him. But it at that point, we started getting that, well, if you say that kind of thing on the air, I'm going to snap the radio station off and I'm never going to listen to you ever again. Now, most of the time you hear that stuff and it's crap anyway. And, you know, I can point to people who have sent that same I'm never going to listen to you ever again email 50 times over a couple of years. but sometimes they mean it. And if that's you, again, I don't care what your political viewpoint is. I don't care what it was that turned you off in the first place. If you're the kind of person who says, because of a thing you just said, I'm never, ever going to listen to you again, you're a baby. You're an infant. You shouldn't be allowed to listen to talk radio or read books or anything else like that because they're going to be meaningless to you. You don't have the brain power to assimilate that into an experience.
Well, I don't know where we're at with society in general now. I have nothing but a very unhealthy contempt for just about everyone, and that's really off-putting to me. You know, I've always claimed that I'm a bit of a misanthrope, but you know, the way people act, outwardly act, that's the whole thing.
Right.
It's shameful. It really is, and I blame social media, a majority of it, because it's the sheep-like mentality, and let's not forget, you know, on social media, you can have the most puffed chest bravado and, you know, I've got the biggest dick so I can swing it around and say whatever. Oops, did I say something wrong just now? I said, I've got a big dick and I can swing it. Ooh.
I'm triggered. I've been triggered now.
Yep, trigger. But if you know someone and you actually pull them aside and have a conversation with them and say, what was that you were talking about on social media? And then they kind of backpedal. That's what makes it even more egregious because yep. They're kowtowing to the popular opinion on social media.
Right, and they don't mean it.
Absolutely nothing.
Right, and if you don't mean the words that you say, then how can you get that upset about the words somebody else says? I mean, I was watching Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, as a matter of fact, this morning, and it was an old episode from about 4 or 5 years ago with Ricky Gervais, and he put it perfectly. He said, you know, the older I get, the more irritated I become with what I like to call other people. Just thought, you know what? Yes, exactly. Because it is. It's getting to that point where just everybody irritates the shit out of me.
It's because of blatant stupidity.
Yes.
Childish stupidity. Everybody's turned back into a teenager. A spoiled, petulant teenager. I swear to God, John, yep. It's just a collective hissy fit.
Right, yeah. And I'm glad you put it in that term as well, because we've been talking about people acting in an infantile manner or acting like third graders. But when you were a teenager, and not just you, but everybody, not only were we still effectively children in the way that we viewed the world, but we also were hormonal assholes on top of it. And that, I think, is why teenager is the perfect thing to call them.
You know, and the funny thing is, I thought a lot about myself at that point in life. Let's say the more enlightened years, and I'm using enlightened in quotation marks, of my adolescence, because 13 to 16, you're not really that smart.
Right.
And I can say this much as memory will allow me to serve. From about 13 to 16, I was very physically awkward, very clumsy, couldn't really walk even in a straight line. Anything and everything that seemed to come out of my mouth never made any sense. And I was always blindly angry, you know. I wasn't violent. I was just angry, you know. Right. There was something that wasn't right. Once I hit about 17, you know, I started the fog started to kind of lift. You know, I started to become aware of a lot more at the time what I considered important things. And I didn't spend a lot of time at home. I always spent every waking hour I could after school either working on music, writing songs, writing lyrics, or going into the city, because the city was where everything was, you know. It was where music was and where clothes were and bookstores and you know, meeting interesting new people and having your horizons expanded. But, you know, when you're in that age from about 17, 18 to the first few years of college, you are incredibly, albeit altruistically naive. You know, your heart is in the right place, but you figure out later on you're wrong about 90% of everything you passionately believed in when you were of that age. Yeah. You know, because honestly, and I have said, and this is where, you know, the whole point of conversations that I've had concerning this topic and our own adolescence is that if I met me as him, speaking of him as that other person, I'd probably slap some smarts into him by now.
Right. And, you know? And the thing that's the hardest to take about it, and this actually can take us away from politics for just a minute and into one of the other things we had lined out to talk about today, is that nothing can be, and we've talked some about this before, nothing can be moderate. Everything has got to be extreme. And this goes back to what we talked about on the show last week with the idea that, oh, you know, they're ruining Kavanaugh's life. Oh, no, they're not. He might not get a job. Let's not call that ruining somebody's life, shall we?
Right, right. He won't get the promotion. He still has a job.
Right.
It's not like he's going to walk into, if he doesn't get the nomination or doesn't get moved on to the Supreme Court, it's not like he's going to walk into the courtroom and they're going to say, sorry, but you're fired.
Yeah, right. You're going to have to go live in a box underneath an overpass now. So, and your family's, they're gone. Your wife left you and your kids are gone. And so, yeah, you just have nothing left. That's never going to happen. And that's not in the offing here. Well, a similar thing happened during just after the sentencing of Bill Cosby. And I was already angry enough that they had so far diluted the possible sentence that he could have gotten, because I think he deserves a lot more time in prison than he got. But that aside, right after the sentencing was over, you heard a courthouse steps, not really a press conference, but more of a statement from the prosecution saying, we did our job, he's going to prison now, and justice has been served as much as it could be. Right after that, Bill Cosby's defense team, and in fact, I don't even know that it was one of the lawyers. I think it was a spokesman who came out and said that it was the most racist and sexist trial in American history. Now, even if you're going to try to make the case that Bill Cosby's in prison because he's black, to call this the most racist trial in American history pretty much says, yeah, suck it, Dred Scott. I mean, does anybody think ever?
No, they don't. They just want to shoot their mouths off, and they want to use every little old canard they can just drag out of sheer desperation. Especially because, okay, the trial's over now, I can just say what I want.
Right.
So we're going to blindly accuse everyone of being a bunch of racists. I've often said, and I think I'm pretty right about this, is that those who always scream racism the loudest are the biggest racists of all, the biggest race baiters of all, and the biggest purveyors of driving a wedge between just people in general.
And it gives the white racists ammunition, because they can say, see, I told you, every time anything bad happens to a black guy, they're going to scream racism. Well, most of the time it's apropos, but in cases where it's not, you can't go that extra mile and say this is racist. No, he was a rapist and an admitted rapist, and he deserves to go to prison. That's not racism. That's justice.
And that's it right there in a nutshell and end of story. But see, you can't lay that out for people, because you're asking them to, A, stop, think, process, and dare I say it, use just a smattering of objectivity.
Right, and logic, which silly freaking me.
Right. I do want to bring up one thing with you that does cause me some umbrage. You made a reference to us using a certain substance that we should do one of our shows in a state of semi-inebriation, if you will.
Yeah.
Using this what would you call it? The substance. And who are we going to interview? I forgot. We were supposed to interview somebody.
My buddy Lon. But you see, the thing is, I woke up the other morning. Here's the genesis of that.
Well, now hang on.
Okay, I mean, all right.
Because the point being is that the good Lord forbids us to alter our consciousness with any kind of substances, especially something like the devil's pepper.
Yeah, right.
And you're bringing this up, you know, on a Sunday, which is, you know, the good Lord's day of rest, you know, when we should all be home reading our Bibles.
What better way to rest than get high?
John, I can understand something. Jesus doesn't love you.
No, that's true. I've known that for a while.
And neither do I. You're spitting in the face of the good book, and if you bring this up again, I'm going to have to hit you with the good book repeatedly.
What happened was, what had happened, to use the Saturday Night Live line, what had happened was, I don't even remember what it was, but I woke up It was either Saturday or Sunday, and somebody, I mean, as soon as I turned the TV on and I went over to one of the news stations, somebody used the term talking points. And, you know, it was like, oh, you're just, you're just relying on the same old liberal talking points. It was the same blah, blah, blah that's on all the Sunday morning shows. So I guess it was Sunday morning. And, but the way that whoever it was said it, it didn't come out exactly right. And it sounded more like they said toking points. And I thought, what a great name for a show. Toking points. You have a couple of guys get high and start talking about politics. I mean, we already have Drunk History on Comedy Central, which is great. So why not have a stoner's political discussion called Toking Points? I think it's a natch.
Well, I'll forgive you this one time for your transgressions, Bio. Because, like I said, the good Lord frowns upon it. And because I'm forgiving, because I read the Bible.
Well, I'll do 6 Hail Marys and 3 Hello Dollies. How's that?
That would be very interesting by virtue of the fact that, oh yeah, you're a Jew.
Yeah, there's that.
We haven't had a round of, Jew in the show in a couple of weeks. Mainly because it's been the High Holy Days. See, folks, this is what you call humor.
Yes.
Find it.
Well, see, and you didn't even mention it, but the T-shirt that I'm wearing at the moment is a throwback to one of my favorite movies of all time. This is actually the shirt that Chris Knight wore all the way through Real Genius, which is just a fabulous piece of work. And it's a great T-shirt, and it says Surf Nicaragua. And I'm waiting for somebody to come up to me somewhere, like in a bar or something like that, and make reference to my shirt, having no idea what the hell it is, but just say, oh, that's in bad taste. I'm just waiting for it.
Jesus. That's a really sad statement that you're primed for it, and you're saying it with a smile, and yet I know you're right.
Yeah, I know. It's coming.
That people have become such insufferable, self-absorbed, self-deluded assholes.
So let's talk fun stuff, because there is some. Let's do a little music talk.
Well, let's start with the fact that, and I forgot to tape it, but I'm sure it's on demand. Once again, Sir Paul McCartney is now on 60 Minutes as we speak.
Oh, wow.
So that's a cool thing, obviously. That's number one. Number two, the new Paul Weller album.
Yeah.
Now, you may have to give me a lot of leeway with this one because, it's hard for me to talk about Paul Weller, duh, with objectivity. The thing is I separate the Paul Weller of the Jam from the Paul Weller of the Style Council and the solo career. Now, this new album, True Meanings, is his 14th solo record. You have to think, and he's just turned 60 this past May. You have to think, what are we going to get now? But here's the caveat that's most important. Since around 2010, you don't know what to expect, which is fantastic. Because starting with Wake Up the Nation, which I thought was just so fucking good right out of the box, because it was one of the most rocking things he had done, akin from the canon of the Jam, he hadn't done anything like that since 13 years prior with Heavy Soul, which is still probably it's tied with Wildwood for my favorite of his solo albums. Wildwood was the album that confirmed for me, he's back.
Okay.
But Heavy Soul just had everything right. He hit all the right marks with it. So Wake Up the Nation comes out. And of course, this is the album that reunited him with Jam bass player Bruce Foxton. So that did have something to do with some of the punch, if you will. Since then, he has put out Saturn's Pattern, which was just the heaviest thing that he had done. He put out Sonic Kicks, which was him using electronic music in a way that you actually felt it, rather than the mechanicalness, if you will, of electronic music. Because no matter what, it's great for touches and embellishments. But as a body of a song, it always leaves you feeling a little on the cold side because it doesn't feel like there's any firepower in electronic music. I'm sorry.
Right.
He utilized it the right way. And A Kind Revolution was him, just getting down, being funky, having groove again. So I was thinking, what is True Meanings going to be like? And I can honestly say that I think this might be the album of his career.
I agree.
I'm not saying it lightly. And I say it because, first of all, in a lot of ways, and I have no indications of anything, so I want to say that right off the bat, it's almost like the coda to a story that began a really long time ago, but you can see it coming to its natural conclusion, and it's a happy ending, if you will. Now, that's maybe just my imagination stretching it a bit, but True Meanings, I had a notion that after reading the lyrics, before even hearing the songs, that this was something of a spiritual journey kind of album, and it is. I mean, it may not be an intentional thing, but as a concept, it works perfectly because it's about love, inner peace, tranquility, understanding, acknowledgement, the passing of time, the passing of people. And it's very low voltage. It is, I would say, 99.44% acoustic based.
Yep.
With a lot of really beautiful orchestrations. Some of his guests are, his last rounds of guests have all been just so remarkable. This time he includes Rod Argent, Danny Thompson. For those who don't know, Danny Thompson most notably is the double bass player from Pentangle, which was a band that I absolutely loved. Noel Gallagher makes a return. These songs are nothing short of exquisite.
Yeah.
They are powerful. They are moving. They are touching. They are meaningful. There is depth and width to them. There is, you know, yeah, he's 60, but there's the beauty of this is that when you're of our age range and you've been on this ride with him for so long, it becomes part of your story too. So it's a very personal album, not just from him, but for all of us.
Well, see, that right there is the genius behind this, because how do you take a personal conversation between two people, which is what any good artwork is, and make it universal? I mean, you think about it on its face, and that sounds like an impossibility, and yet Paul Weller did it with this record. You're absolutely right.
And he did it with such ease, too.
Yeah.
I mean, the lyrics, yeah. The lyrics to some of the songs leave you just, you know, first of all, it leaves you with your mouth dropped open of just the sheer beauty of his skill as a poet, because he's always been a master of the language.
Yep.
You know, the only other songwriter that I can think of, certainly in our generation, because I don't want to go harkening back to the 60s, is Andy Partridge. But Partridge is more of a reporter. Weller is more of a if Andy Partridge is the reporter, Weller is the preacher. And I don't mean that in the bombastic, you know, pulpit kind of way, but the preacher spreading love, you know, the message of love. He's spreading the gospel. And just to give you a very brief snippet of what it's like, there's a song on there called Bowie. Now, it's twofold, because he named one of his sons Bowie. For those who might not know, Weller had a longstanding feud with the late, great Mr. David Jones. They patched it up somewhere around 2008. And I don't know really what spurred Weller on to get in touch with Bowie, but they did patch things up. They actually formed a friendship afterwards, even though Bowie had a fantastic, you know, zinger of a one line to Weller in his reply email. By the way, can I have my haircut back? Referencing the old haircut that Bowie had back in the 60s, you know, the old mod look. But they had forged a friendship. Weller had openly admitted that he had refound his love of, you know, the early Bowie stuff. And especially of, he said, it didn't matter, you know, what I was thinking or how I felt, but I always thought Low was a magnificent record and has always been part of my turntable since it came out in 77, which is kind of an interesting statement, you know, all these years after the fact. With the passing of David Bowie, he wrote the song in dedication to him. And the lyrics are just so beautiful and simple and eloquent, but powerful in its simplicity. But letting go is thanking.
Let go.
says it all, you know, because it's the last line in the song and it says everything.
Yeah.
You know?
And there's so much in here that I found, I mean, as you said, the lyricism is absolutely brilliant, but the fact that it's laid over top of these very delicate kinds of melodies, specifically, you see, and you talked about Bowie sticking out to you. The one that spoke to me immediately on my first listen through was Glide. And I don't know who it is. Maybe you can fill in the blank here. Who's playing guitar opposite him on Glide?
It may be either him overdubbed with Steve Craddock.
Yeah, that sounds right. But the two of them, the interplay between the two guitars, yeah. And they're effectively doing the same thing. But in the parts where they diverge, it works so well. And then I mean, they come back together. The musicality behind all of this is wonderful.
All the fears that kept you awake, the night was strangely calm. Try, see the memories unfold. Don't leave me waiting in this place so strange and cold. Dark and lonely world, where I glide way up high.
And then you start listening to the lyrics, and that's where there's a little bit, as much as I'm almost loath to say this, there is a little bit of a comparison to vocally on this, because, you know, his delivery is never the same from one album to the next, to Eric Clapton. I heard some of that start to come out. The major difference is that Clapton was never half the songwriter that Paul Weller was. So to hear it really come to its fruition in a way that has meaning to you is like, wow, okay, this is what could have been. I'm amazed that we haven't heard more of this all the way along.
Actually, it was Steve Brooks who plays opposite of Weller.
Okay.
And if we've never talked about Steve Brooks, Steve Brooks was the co-founder of the Jam with Weller when they were teenagers, and they rekindled their friendship somewhere in the 90s, you know, after many, many years apart, and are just as close now, if not closer than ever before. So it was he who was playing opposite of Weller with that wonderful acoustic cascade where they're both playing the riffs around each other.
Yes.
See, Glide, Aspects, and May Love Travel With You are the three that really stood out for me. Bowie is obvious because I don't recall Weller ever making such a pointed statement about anyone in that manner, right? But also, Old Castle stuck out simply because, to me, upon first listen, it was like a revisit to the old Jam song, Shopping, which was the very last B-side of their last single, Beat Surrender. It sounds a lot alike. It has that jazzy inflection to it, except this one's far more sophisticated than when they first did that song back in 1982. But, you know, this album as a whole, that's the whole thing. It needs to be heard as a whole piece. It can't just be parsed out and I'll listen to this song and I'll listen to that song. No, you got to take it and listen to the whole thing and listen to it over and over again, because it starts to live within you as a whole piece.
Right. And there's one other thing, and because you brought up Old Castles, I wonder if you heard the same thing that I did, because I'm not entirely convinced. Again, I'm going to have to go back through and listen word for word to everything several times, which, by the way, will be a pleasure to do with this one. But it almost seemed like, again, musically, this goes back to the day when albums had sides, when tapes had sides, because I heard White Horses, which is the last song on the album, is almost not a reprise, but a response to Old Castles. Did you hear a connection between them?
I did. And the thing is, since it did come out on, it is out on vinyl, it wouldn't be a surprise.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
You know, I think Paul Weller is definitely one of those artists who are of the mind that, even though albums now are looked upon as a cool novelty to have reappeared, he still thinks and plans albums out as albums, which I appreciate. You know, when I listen, not to throw myself into the mix here, but when I mapped out the Punchline album to get to the other side, even though it's only available on CD, I mapped it out as an album. And I still think of it as side A and B, you know, side one and side two. I was never comfortable with, you know, just putting the songs 1 through 10 or whatever it was, 1 through 12. It was just, you know, side one and side two.
Yeah.
And subsequently, I think that's what Paul had done. But I am so beyond impressed with this record. Like I said, it's not something that I say lightly or as a fan, because, you know, on the emotional side of things, it all begins and ends for me with Sound Effects in 1980. You know, because it's Revolver.
Right.
You know, it's in that triad, actually, in that, I'm sorry, I should take that back, because the holy triad, of course, is Revolver, Sellout, and Number One Record, immediately followed by Sound Effects, and then Murmur at number five. But, you know, of a career that's now 41 years in a recording studio, the fact that he's 60 years old and can deliver something like this, it makes you, it gives you hope.
Yeah.
You know, as we get older, that some of the people that we have in essence grown up with can still deliver,
right,
once more, just for the sake of, you know what, dip into the bag and see what you've still got, you know, see if you still love it enough to give it that effort, because that's what it's about. And this record shows effort. It's,
yeah,
a very focused album. That's what makes it so good. It is so complete and tethered together so well.
Right, and so, you don't have to be 22 years old to do something that's meaningful. That's a wonderful way to put it.
You just have to have a heart. That's the main thing about this record. If you have a heart, if you have a soul, listen to it. You can think about it, but feel it.
Right.
Because that's what this album is completely about. Feel.
Yeah, and it's like Mick Jagger said, it's not only do you have to have a heart, you have to be willing to spill it all over the page. So it all works. This is one you have to pick up, and now that I know there is a vinyl release, I'm going to go check that out on vinyl as well, just to hear a little bit of added nuance and ambience. And, you know, we'll move away from music a little bit. We'll get back to it certainly within our heads, but there are some other things going on in the world of commerce that bear our attention this week. Not the least of which is, I saw something on Facebook today about, it was a haunted house that somebody had built in an old Toys R Us. And now all the Toys R Us are old because they're all closed. But it still had that ghost of the old sign up on the wall, and you could see it. And they were making a joke about how, you know, what a great way to celebrate Halloween by building a haunted house on the corpse of our childhood. And I thought that was kind of clever. But really, everything is becoming like that. And it seems like not a week goes by that we don't hear of yet another brick and mortar store, even if it's one that hasn't been around that long, that's seeing rough waters ahead. Every chain is in some kind of trouble now.
Absolutely. I mean, just this week I read that Bed Bath & Beyond are in, you know, kind of in deep shit at the moment. So, you know, I don't know where we're going. I mean, we have to have brick and mortar stores because people need to work.
Yeah.
You know, there needs to be a physical place to get what you need. You can't just order something and wait for it when you need it right away. That is the whole point of brick and mortar stores. I don't have any answers. The greater Pac-Manning of the entire planet, as it seems by a company like Amazon, is kind of daunting and frightening.
Yeah.
I've never had great problems with or against Amazon, but just every time you turn around, they're taking over something else and driving something else out of business.
Right.
So it leaves me feeling very uneasy.
Well, it should. And I think, again, all you need to do is look into history and realize we have been here before. This was what the 19-teens, the aughts and the teens and the 20s were all about, was building the system that for the next 70 years kept us relatively in line. But the thing is, what we forget about, because we read this history in very dry terms, and we hear about Glass-Steagall, and we hear about all of the Sherman Antitrust Act and all of this stuff, and all we remember are the dates, if we even remember that much about it. But what they didn't tell us, that I think they should have, was the incredible pain that was involved in building those things. You know, those wildcat strikes in Chicago and New York, they were met with people being shot. And they were met with police forces that were bought and paid for and owned by the corporations that ran those towns. And, you know, you had guys who were being beaten with nightsticks because a corporate boss was paying the police department to beat that guy with a nightstick so that they wouldn't unionize. We've gone through this already once. You'd figure that somebody would be smart enough to look back and go, you know, we really probably don't want to go through this again. And the reasons are exactly the same, because people couldn't earn a living and they were starving in the streets. Well, we're not quite to that point yet, but we'll get there. If this keeps up, if that rubber band between the very rich and the very poor gets stretched to the point where it snaps, there is only one thing that happens, and that is revolution. And not in the pansy let's sing about it and protest in the streets way, in the way that people get lined up against the wall and get shot for being too rich. That's the shit that has happened in the past. It's going to happen again, unless somebody steps in and does something about it.
Well, the problem is you've got too many people advocating the whole notion of it.
Right. And they've convinced
us it's irresponsible.
Right. And they've convinced the poor people that this is the way it should be, that eventually they'll get theirs too. Wow.
Well, on the brighter side of things, though, apparently Cadillac is moving their headquarters out of New York and back to Detroit.
Yeah.
So that's something to be said for things being where they should be, if you will.
Right. It's better than it not being there, but it's not going to solve Cadillac's problems. Cadillac's problems go far deeper than that. And a lot of what they're going through right now has to do with the fact that they still don't know what they want their identity to be. They had an identity and they just didn't like it because it was too many old people. And so they said, oh, you know, we're going to make the Cadillac CTS. And this, you know, this is all going back 20 years. And we're going to be, you know, a hip, cool version of Cadillac. Well, okay. You're never going to convince kids that you're hip and cool, and all you're going to do is piss off the 80-year-olds who are already buying your cars, which is, it's borne out by, they can't figure out what the hell they want to sell or to whom.
Well, hell, I'd rather drive a Cadu than a Buick.
True.
Buick is just a field car, man.
But you're not a soccer mom. You know, if you were a soccer mom living in St. Charles County, which is west of St. Louis, then yes, you would love to drive a Buick. Because
but all the soccer moms here, they all drive, you know, either drove PT Stupids or what do you call it, or minivans.
Right. Well, see, now they drive these, it's the Buick. Shit, I can't even remember the model names, but there's three different levels of small SUV that Buick has out there, and that's where they sell them. They sell them all to women who use a lot of hairspray.
Jesus.
Yep.
The only Buicks I know are the LeSabre and the Electra 225.
Those are the only two that should exist.
Exactly. It's like, you know, the Eldorado and the Seville. And then, of course, you know, in my book, it's all about the Cutlass.
Right.
Or the Le Mans.
which is effectively, yeah, the same, cut from the same mold. But yeah, I mean, in Lincoln, similarly, they never gave up their 80-year-old audience. They still make Continentals that they sell to guys who are 80 years old and fairly well off. But they also found that they could sell the Navigator to rappers and football players and, you know, and anybody who had enough money to want to be like them and was okay with that. They were able to have a duality to their image that Cadillac never figured out.
Well, growing up, Cadillac and Lincoln were two status symbols.
Right.
If you had either one in the neighborhood I grew up in, you'd made it.
Yep.
Financially. So, you know, we never had either one of those. You know, we had an Opel Kadett. We had a Plymouth Volare.
My mom drove a Granada.
my dad got a Buick Regal, which I liked that car a lot. Then he had a Pontiac. I don't remember what the the comparable to the Regal was, it was the same style, but it was a Pontiac. And then he got himself a Thunderbird because he'd always wanted a Thunderbird.
Yeah. It was a Pontiac. Oh, what was it? I feel like I should know this.
Was it a Grand Prix?
I was going to say, I think, yeah, it was Grand something. Yeah, probably. Well, like, yes, the Regal was the Grand Prix, yes.
79-80.
Right.
You know? And then, you know, the only cars I ever had was, a 70 Cutlass, an 88 Le Mans when they brought them back. I had the four-door version made by Daewoo. And for a while, I used my dad's 92 Nissan Sentra, and now I have a 2007 RAV4.
Yeah.
And which I bought and paid for myself, so therefore it's going to last as long as possible. And so far, knock wood, it's running well. But now, you know, let's veer off into other, interesting little points about commerce and industry, because this seems to be the week of let's all lose our minds and rebrand established goods as something completely stupid. Case in point, Dunkin' Donuts announces it's dropping donuts from its name and just calling themselves Dunkin'. How fucking dumb are you?
Let's start with the fact that Dunkin' is a yo-yo company. Thank you very much.
That's number one. Number two, Dunkin' what? What are you dunkin'?
Right.
Dunkin' your balls in my coffee? I mean, Dunkin', come on. What the fuck? Well, we want to concentrate more on our coffee drinks. You're known for your fucking donuts.
Right. But everybody wants to be Starbucks, and I hate Starbucks.
And Starbucks calls themselves Starbucks Coffee.
Right.
When you walk past the shop, it says Starbucks Coffee.
Yep.
That's the whole point. Dunkin' sells donuts.
Yeah.
End of fucking story. And don't give me that, well, look at KFC. No, it's just easier and faster to say KFC than Kentucky Fried Chicken all the fucking time.
KFC ditched that, though. They went back to Kentucky Fried Chicken. Exactly. They got rid of it for 20 years, and then they brought it back.
John, remember what we're dealing with now.
Yeah.
Okay. And then who else? Weight Watchers is no longer Weight Watchers. It's just WW.
Which is longer and harder to say than Weight Watchers.
Right.
Okay. Huh. That makes no sense at all.
Of course, now Papa John's is going to rebrand by removing the apostrophe.
That's right. The apostrophe is gone. That fixes everything.
Ooh. I'm telling you, you fuck with the formula and everything goes to shit.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
Remember New Coke?
Thankfully, I will not bring it up. All I can say is I'm drinking a bottle of what says original taste.
Does it still? I'm surprised they even make reference to it anymore.
Yeah, it's funny. They don't say classic. It just says original taste.
That's okay. Every so often, I'll go to my local grocery store and they will have 1 6-pack of cans of Tab. And if I see it there, I will buy it.
Yeah, it's funny. I never liked Tab, so I embraced Diet Coke when it came along because I was on a diet at the time.
Oh, yeah.
But I really have come to the conclusion that after 34 years of drinking Diet Coke, I just can't stand it anymore because it's awful.
It is.
I hate Diet Soda. No matter how you slice it, Diet Soda tastes like shit.
Right. But it's all I can drink. See, you're lucky because you can drink stuff with sugar in it. I can't.
I alternate between the two. I still do drink Diet Coke. I just hate it.
Yep.
You know, on weekends, it's kind of like being the weekend drinker. You know, I'll drink a Dr. Pepper or a regular Coke. Weekdays, I drink Diet Coke.
The only time that I will make an exception is every so often. Again, I'll go to not my regular grocery store, but there's a Big Lots fairly nearby. Do they have Big Lots in New York? Is that a thing there?
We had them. They left. They're in Jersey, though.
Okay. So I'll go to Big Lots, and they'll have birch beer. And if they have birch beer, I don't care if it's going to make me groggy for the rest of the day. It's worth it. I'm going to drink one.
You give me a good bottle of root beer and I'm happy.
Yeah.
I prefer A&W root beer because to me that's the apex of root beer.
I'm a Heyer's guy.
The king of root beer.
I'm a Heyer's guy, but I do respect A&W. I like a good frosty root beer as well.
And Stewart's.
Stewart's is great.
Not cheap.
And Dr. Brown's, which if you're going to get into that upper echelon of Stewart's, then Dr. Brown's is the one I like.
Because I'm in New York and because we are of the chosen people, there's only two kinds of Dr. Brown's to drink. Cream soda.
Yeah.
Diet kind. and black cherry, because I will not touch celery soda. I'm sorry. I do have my limits, and that stuff is icky.
Yeah. Well, there's one other commerce thing, but you reminded me of something in a very roundabout way that I want to go off on for a couple of minutes. But there's one other thing that happened this week, and you're right. As far as the rebranding stuff goes, it's pointless. It's enough for a bunch of marketing guys to try to keep their jobs, and they shouldn't have them anyway.
Somebody tried to say, well, look, it worked for IHOP. Yeah, but it was a stunt. It wasn't a rebranding.
It was never real, right.
And they even said this is a stunt.
Yep.
We're really not called IHOP.
Right. And now they have their own beer, too, on top of everything else. But whatever. If IHOP's going to have their own branded beer, why don't they sell it in the stores? That's weird to me.
I cannot answer. I'm not an asshole in marketing.
There you go. Now, the other one is the Apple, the new iPhone. As ridiculous and stupid as this is, and I am an iPhone user, but mine is an iPhone 6S. So that'll tell you about how far behind the times I am with this stuff. As ridiculous as this is, there may be no better named item than the iPhone XS, because holy shit, is it ever.
How bad is this?
All of this is excessive.
I don't get it, and I'm glad that I don't get it. And I'm not going to lay claim to wanting to understand why people have such an obsession. And I mean obsession with their phones.
Oh, yeah.
No one's life is that important.
Nope.
I'm sorry. Mine isn't. Nobody's is. I have a cell phone because, unfortunately, it is what our society now deems not a necessity, but you have to be tethered to the damn thing because of work more than anything else. Otherwise, you know where the hell I am. I'm either in the office or I'm here. You know, if you don't get me, it's not an emergency. If it's an emergency, you'll call me, you'll leave me a message, or you'll text me. If it's some kind of sundry nonsense, it can wait, and I'm not going to rush to reply. And I'm not saying that to be an asshole or contrarian or any of that. It's just that nothing is that important.
No.
I play video games. I don't download shit onto my phone. You know, I have a smattering of all free apps that are of necessity or interest to me. And that's it.
Yeah.
You know, like you, I'm on an iPhone 6. So I got mine in June of 2015. And so far, it's still in pristine condition. I haven't had any problems with it, thankfully. When it can no longer be used because the upgrades are at that saturation point, you can't go any further, maybe then I'll go and upgrade to a newer model of something. But, you know, I am not someone who gets it. Maybe because I choose not to, because I just see right through it. But I had to go to the Apple store in Soho on Thursday for my boss. And although there was an interesting encounter I did have in there, I went there for his MacBook to be fixed. But the people that were just swarming like bees for the new iPhones was frightening. And I do mean frightening.
What do they get out of it?
I don't know. It's not like you get, you know, cookies, or they don't even give you soft drinks, you know, while you're waiting for this new $1,000 toy. But while I was waiting at the Genius Bar, sat next to me someone who looked very familiar, and I realized it was indeed Catherine Keener.
Oh, wow. She's great.
I'll tell you something. She's an incredibly beautiful woman.
Yep.
Au naturel. And very nice, because we struck up a conversation. I didn't, you know, do any of the, you were magnificent, you know, holding your own against Rainbow fucking Randolph. But, you know, I didn't let on that I know who she is.
Yeah.
She was this very nice woman sitting next to me, you know, who was there to get her laptop fixed, you know. So that was kind of like the nice trade-off for having to be in a hell like the Soho Apple store. Nevertheless, I want to move on to a different kind of commerce, because corporations give me a headache. But today is the day of the end of the official end of the baseball season. I will say that my beloved New York Mets ended it with a win. Last night they won in 13 innings, 1-0 on the final night of David Wright's career. Today was probably the end of certainly Jose Reyes' career with the Mets, if not his career outright. So again, a little on the melancholic side, but the Mets went 18-10 for the month of September, and that's pretty impressive for a team that was depleted and basically fielding a minor league team. You know, I'm very, very happy with the way they salvaged the season in August, starting with their absolute annihilation of the Phillies after the Mets themselves had gotten trounced a week before by the Nationals. The Nationals go home with nothing. The Phillies go home with nothing. But tomorrow, there are going to have to be two more games, the 163rd games of the season, because there are four first-place teams at this moment.
Wow.
In the Central Division, the Chicago Cubs and Milwaukee Brewers are tied for first place. And in the West, the Colorado Rockies and Los Angeles Dodgers are tied. The Dodgers allegedly being the absolute favorite. The Rockies, nobody saw it coming. Which I love that.
Yeah.
I personally would love to see the Rockies beat the Dodgers and the Brewers beat the Cubs. But that's just me. The only one in the National League who won their thing outright was the Braves in the East. And congratulations to them because they basically fielded also a minor league team.
Yeah, a team full of nobodies.
Starts, and that's terrific.
Right.
It's absolutely terrific. It's terrific for an incredibly great fan base, too. So congratulations to the Braves. Apart from David Wright leaving baseball, Joe Mauer of the Twins is leaving, and it was announced after the game ended that Mike Socha of the Los Angeles Angels, their manager of 19 years, has decided to walk away from it. So that's kind of big because 19 years as a baseball manager is not often heard of anymore.
Right.
You really don't get that. Now, with the end of the baseball season, it also opens up the free agent market because, of course, Bryce Harper of the Nationals is the biggest prize in sport. And, of course, there were tears and accolades at the last homestand because most people think that was the last time they'd see him in a Nats uniform. This week, the Phillies basically let the cat out of the bag that they're not just going to try and attempt to woo Bryce Harper, but they're going after he and Manny Machado when his free agency begins as soon as this playoff with the Dodgers is over. That kind of nonsense is what's killing baseball.
Yep.
Because baseball is the worst for most overinflated contracts. Because it led to the question of if those are the kind of contracts that are going to be, you know, out there, you know, the likes of which nobody can even put a numeric figure on yet for Harper, Machado, or both, when Mike Trout of the Angels is up for free agency, the thought is, and it's almost been already preordained, the Angels want him for life. Okay? They're talking about him becoming the first $500 million player.
I want to see those zeros on a contract.
It doesn't work that way. I'm sorry. No player has ever lived up to the contracts they get.
No.
None of them.
No. What are they going to do when he gets broken in half in his first season under the lifetime contract?
They'll be paying him 20 years after he played for the team.
Yeah. Right.
Just like the Mets are still paying Bobby Bonilla now.
And the thing is that takes teams from smaller markets. And I, you know, as far as baseball is concerned, we're not one because St. Louis actually does fairly well in terms of salary. And, you know, the Cardinals almost made it, even though they had no business coming within sniffing distance of the playoffs this year. They had a hell of a final third of the season and came this close to beating the Brewers out for second place in the NL Central. So congratulations to them for doing more than they thought they would. So it should be an interesting year next year. But, you know, the same thing is true in football, not to the same degree. But you watch teams like my Bills and you say, all right, there's never going to be a time when they're back to being able to compete the way that they were in the early 1990s because the money just isn't there and it's never going to be there. And they're always going to get bought out on the major league talent by teams that have that kind of money to spend. And whatever salary cap is supposed to exist is a joke anyway.
The thing is, there's no salary cap in baseball, and that's a problem.
Yeah.
It really is, because the economics of baseball have dictated time and time again, you're killing your fan base is what you're doing, because you offer out these contracts, and you're trying to pass the buck on to them to have to pay for it all.
Yep.
You know? it doesn't go that way because less people will show up at the games because your prices keep going up. I don't want an experience when I go to see a baseball game. I want to see a fucking baseball game. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm there, you know. I don't need the bells and whistles and rickety-rackety of being entertained by the scoreboard or the music or any of this, you know. I'm not some little kid with OCD, you know. I'm a baseball fan. That's why I'm there to see baseball.
Yep. Yeah, well, and we've got hockey cranking up now, too, so I'm pretty happy about that. I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about through the early part of the season, but you're right. Somebody's got to get a handle on the money in baseball, and I'm fine with guys making a gazillion dollars, but there's got to be some kind of equity, and that's the problem, is that...
As far as hockey season goes, I'm already done because I watched, again, Lundqvist in net, again against the Islanders, again in overtime... And again, they shit the bed.
Right.
With Lundqvist in net. That fucking guy can't play. End of story.
Yeah.
Okay? Trade the son of a bitch now. Divest yourself of that contract. Get the albatross off your back. Let one of these two Russian kids who aren't even on the team yet, because they're going to go to the minors if they haven't already, give them more chances during this preseason and let them show what they can possibly do, because God knows they at least came to play and they at least win those games that – Lundqvist always seems to lose.
Right. Oh, and by the way, one last thing on football before we leave that. My uncle, my dad's little brother, Glenn, came up with the perfect description of Ryan Fitzpatrick, who, by the way, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers got their shit just handed to them by the Chicago Bears today. I think it was 48-10 was the final score, and it wasn't even that close. But my uncle Glenn said, Ryan Fitzpatrick is like when the coyote is chasing the Roadrunner, and the coyote runs off a cliff, but he doesn't fall. He just kind of stands there.
Stands there, and he's staring at the Roadrunner while the Roadrunner just goes...
Right, and then he looks down, and that's when he falls, is when he notices he's out there. So you got Ryan Fitzpatrick, who plays at this incredibly high level, until something happens, and he looks down and realizes he's Ryan Fitzpatrick, and then...
Well, that's what I went through last year with him being the Jets quarterback.
Exactly.
Never mind the fact that he's kind of a dick, too. So,
right. You know. Good old Harvard. But,
well, no, good old Jets. They suck today, too, so enough said.
That aside, so on to the hearings, because we've got to end on this, and I've got something I want to say that is sort of peripherally related to this and why things are going the way they are with the hearings that took place for Kavanaugh's confirmation. First of all, I want to hear from you on Christine Blasey Ford and her testimony and a little juxtaposition with what Brett Kavanaugh did on Thursday.
I'm going to be absolutely honest. I stayed away from all of it.
Did you really? Yeah, you didn't miss much.
I did, because I can't watch these things anymore. They're predictable and they're scripted.
Yep.
You know, it's like watching a really bad soap opera and a divorce proceeding
right.
in that soap opera.
And everybody has to decide before they start their testimony who they're going to be. So you had Brett Kavanaugh say, okay, well, I'm going to be angry guy. I'll be angry, mean guy. And you know, Christine Blasey Ford said, I'll be nice school teachery lady. And so they all played their roles. And of course, Lindsey Graham decided for some reason to start yelling and screaming about all of this as well. And it was a crap show from the very beginning. So that said, the reason why, and everybody keeps saying, okay, how come if this guy was such a schmuck from the very beginning, how come nobody said anything about it? And that's not entirely true. People did along the way, but it was never something that he was going to be punished for. And I've made reference to the fact here and on Facebook and on my radio show and everything else that I have known about things like this that happened. I was never there when they happened. I didn't get invited to those kinds of parties because even though I went to schools where... Well, for example, the president of the New York Yankees was in my class for a while. The guy who runs Daytona Speedway was in my class for a while. I knew those guys, but we were never friends. I was never in their circle because I wasn't a rich asshole. So, the details of the accusations, not just Christine Blasey Ford, but some of the other women who were talking about him, you know, standing in line outside a room, getting ready to pull a train on some drunk girl who was passed out. When that stuff started to come up and people said, oh, things like that couldn't have happened without people talking about it. Oh, yeah. Yes, they could and they did. In fact, not only was it not outside the realm of possibility, it wasn't uncommon You know, it was the kind of thing you would hear about. And there was a girl in my class who was the subject of one of these, let's call it what it was, gang rapes, where she, I wasn't there, but I know what happened. And whether she just got completely plowed or whether somebody slipped or something a la Bill Cosby, that's the only part about it I don't know. But the rest of it is the predictable, yep, she was passed out in a bedroom and they just took turns. And she never showed up at school again. She was so completely overcome with shame that she just disappeared. And where she went, I don't know. I know people who still know her. And here's the part about it that fascinated and sickened me the most. Without putting her name in any way or any details about who she is or any of this, I wrote that story on the day that Kavanaugh gave his testimony, because I thought, if you think this guy couldn't do this, I'm not saying he did it, because I don't know. I don't know him. But if you think he couldn't do this, let me tell you what actually happened out there back in the mid-1980s. And one of the first people that posted was a girl who knew her then and still to some degree knows her now and was probably at the party where it happened to her. And her response was, "You never should have said anything about this. She wouldn't want you to say this." And I thought, okay, the only people being protected by the silence that you're urging me to take part in are the guys who raped her. How the hell could you, a woman, come to the defense of the people that gang raped this girl in high school? So if you want to know how that protective scheme continues to perpetuate itself, that's how it goes. And it's not just the guys who are pulling together and protecting each other. The women are doing it too. And it just, it makes me want to punch somebody. It really does.
Well, all things being equal, and I'm not being funny when I say that, you want to punch the women who are the ones pervading this to let it keep going.
How could you do that?
Well, it's the whole Ellen Jamesian mentality, you know?
Yep.
Silence is more golden than what?
Right.
What?
You know,
if it really happened, then why aren't you there taking matters into your hands where you can without, for lack of a better phrase, putting the person who actually was attacked in peril? If you can convince her to go to the cops and you're there at the party and you know what happens, and I'm spitballing it here, then you band together.
Right.
You get the people who need to go there, go to the police and say, "This happened, here she is, talk to her, run a rape kit, etc."
Right. And the thing is,
these animals walk away.
Right. And make no mistake, if I could have proof of any name of anybody who was at that party and who was involved in that rape of her, and I got a pretty good idea who it was, at least from a list of names. But if I knew for a fact that I could prove that one of them was there, I would be out there right now shouting his name.
Right. But the thing is, because you don't have proof and you don't know, you're because you're using wisdom.
Right.
Basic common sense and wisdom. But, I often think, and it is a woman who said this to me not long ago, and it made me stop to contemplate what she was saying, is that this whole thing with women and, women being strong and bonding together and all that, it's bullshit because they're the same catty bitches that they were in high school, that, they will stab you in the back faster than anybody else.
Right. And
whereas with guys, as horrible as it sounds, we do tend to close ranks around one another because we feel it more necessary to protect ourselves and our, quote, brethren, against this kind of bullshit going on.
Yep.
It's become a war, and I don't know who perpetrated it, and I'm saying it's right or I say it's all wrong, but I want to know who perpetrated it, because all it's doing is now driving greater wedge between men and women, and people aren't going to communicate no matter how you slice it. It's a case of, I have a lot of female friends. And I don't have these conversations with them because I don't think them necessary in our purview and in our little orbit, because it's about the personal interaction and communication. If you're going to generalize me all of a sudden, out amongst the cosmos with people who you don't know, but because I just happen to be part of the male species, then we've got a problem.
Right. Yeah. And that was another thing that came up this week. Johnny Hickman from Cracker was one of the ones who posted about this. And he said, "Look, the only thing that bothers me about this is that as a white male, I feel like people look at me differently now, and they look at me and think, oh, he's one of them. He probably did the same kind of thing. And it's like, no, 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 no. Most of us are your little brothers or your big brothers. And, you know, we're the guys that you knew in high school who never hurt anybody. And, you know, most of us were not this, and we still aren't. But, you know, if there is that potential to be broad brushed because you look like you could be.
Looked like you could be.
Yep.
Think about those words.
I know.
How grand they are.
You know? Right.
And that's why in part, all of this is part of why I have stayed completely away from this shit show.
Yeah.
And I would rather be not willfully ignorant, but by choice, you know, wise to stay away from something that I have no business meddling into. And I feel a lot better about it because that way I can watch from the peripheral view and say, I don't know. And so by not knowing, it keeps me, you know, sometimes it's better to be the fool.
Right.
It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just one last point on this, and I'll make this one as quick as I can. There was another friend of mine who was on the air with me every day, and he said, you know, I notice you haven't said whether or not you think Kavanaugh did it. And he goes, you know, you don't know anybody objectivity. You can have thoughts on this like anybody else does. And what I tried to get across from to him is that I wasn't avoiding saying whether or not I think he did it because of some phony objectivity. I was doing it because I know I can't be fair to him. And I don't really owe him being fair anyway, but I owe it to myself. And if I know, because I would, if I judged him, I would be judging him based on people that I knew who I think are like him, not on him. You know what I mean? And that's not fair.
You're using the composite memory of someone else, and you're looking at him and hearing what they're saying, and suddenly he's part of that crowd.
Right.
So you're not able to look at him and say, I don't know, or I don't think he did it, or he did it.
Right.
You can't come across. It's not going to work if you're the judge and jury.
Right. And that's why I said, you know, my first instinct would be, yeah, of course he did. But it's not because of him. It's because of them. And that I you know, like I said, I don't feel like that's a fair way to judge somebody, is because you remind me of some guy that I knew who would pull some shit like that. So, yeah. So, I like you said, try to stay away from it.
And here's the thing, we've gotten dragged into that kind of thing as a society now with all of this, you know, Me Too movement bullshit, because a lot of the Me Too movement is bullshit.
Right.
And we have found out the hard way, although with the you know, you and I saying, told you so, not happily, but still able to say told you so when lies and bullshit stories come out.
And
therefore, you know, what it is it's an automatic conviction of anybody and everybody who you feel fits the suit.
Right. Which is, again, the McMartin preschool thing all over again. And we remember how that ended. So, yeah, it's and the thing is, at the end of it all, it doesn't make any difference what I think anyway. You know what I mean? Me thinking he did it or not makes no difference whatsoever in anybody's life, least of all his or hers.
What we're doing here is we're able to have a friendly conversation about these
right.
things. And the thing is that we're looking at it from each other's perspectives,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. You feel a different way about it because you don't know something, but it's from a different perspective of not knowing.
Right.
And we're able to say that, you know, we're looking at it from all angles and can't make a judgment call. That's called being enlightened, not in the higher being way, but being enlightened, excuse me, by all the facts you're able to accumulate and trying. And that's the key word, trying to keep everyone's podium pounding opinions out.
Yes.
And of drawing your own conclusion.
Right. And really what it comes down to is, you know, while I'm keeping everybody else out, I'm trying to recognize my own biases and not be a victim of them. So I know too many people who have become a victim of their own biases, and I just won't do that. I still have them. You know, they'll always exist.
So think about this, what you've just said, because it's so unbelievably poignant and important. It's the fact that, you know, we are now forced to automatically have these biases.
Right.
You know what I mean? We've now become byproducts of this force feeding, over inundation, browbeating of the, you know, drum bangers, the hashtaggers, and every other asshole who wants their 5 minutes in the sun of trying to say that, you know, this movement or that movement is relevant.
Right.
You know, they're all trying to get – everybody's trying to get a movement relevant, you know, when it's a case of up against the wall motherfuckers. And speaking of which, a very sad duff cap to the late – now late great Martin Buchenwald, a.k.a. Marty Balin of the Jefferson Airplane / Starship – who we lost on Friday.
Yes, and thank you so much for saying that, because we would have gone right into In Our Heads and I would have felt horrible about it, because over the years I've had several opportunities to talk to him and have been in the same room with him at least once or twice, and I love the guy. What an incredible voice, and as I said on Facebook this week, the heart of a true poet. I just really, I love, you know, not even necessarily the music itself. I love what he did with his solo career. I love what he meant to the Airplane. I mean, it's just, the world is a sadder place. It has a hole in it now that Marty Balin's not in it anymore.
He was a great singer. He was the founder of the Jefferson Airplane. He also knew when to leave it.
Yep.
That's what I really respected about
him. And when to come back.
That too. The thing is, I couldn't stand Jefferson's Starship. But I loved the Airplane, especially when I was a kid. And, you know, I more than anything, I always found his songs were the ones I liked the most, especially the first two albums, because they were pretty much driven by him. I mean, you listen to Jefferson Airplane Takes Off, and Grace Slick isn't even on that album.
Yeah.
She wasn't, you know, she wasn't part of the group at that time. It was a woman named Signe Anderson, who was the co-lead singer with Marty Balin, you know, and their vocals together sounded magnificent. There was a real soul to it, and the lyrics themselves were just absolutely fantastic. The man could write like nobody's business.
Yeah. Well, and you talk about a piece of rock and roll history, the Altamont Festival, that just absolute nightmare that happened, and it ended with people getting stabbed and all of that. Everybody remembers the Rolling Stones. Everybody remembers Jimi Hendrix being a part of that. And what gets lost in that is that the very first fight that happened that day was Marty Balin on stage taking a punch to the face by one of the Hell's Angels, a guy named Animal.
And then Paul Kantner saying on stage, I want to thank the Hell's Angels for punching my lead singer in the fucking face.
Right. And then they dragged Balin back to the bus, and he was back there for a couple of minutes. He got his wits back about him, went out there and finished the set. What a badass.
And the thing is, you know, he never, if you think about it, he never compromised his writing for the Jefferson Airplane and turned it into the psychedelic bag that was so fashionable.
Right.
You know? He wrote very from the heart kind of lyrics. And I think that was his unfortunate undoing in that band that just seemed to be overdriven by egos and drugs.
Yep.
But by his own admission, you know, he'd stopped drinking by the time that he, you know, Volunteers had come out. He wasn't drinking, he didn't do drugs, you know, he was more into a healthy lifestyle. And when you've got a sense of clarity and your wits about you and you're an intelligent human being to begin with, which the man obviously was, you look around you and you can see, you know, you can see the bullshit for what it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was then that he started to very wisely, you know, divorce himself from the Airplane. But the thing is, without him, there was no Jefferson Airplane.
Yep.
Marty Balin was the Jefferson Airplane, you know, as much as I always said it was, I was never a fan of Paul Kantner's, to be honest with you. I always liked Marty Balin and Jorma Kalkinen.
Yeah. So Jorma's got new music out as well. So we can do some more talking about him on a future show, but all kinds of cool stuff going on. And we have something going on in town this week that also has a repercussion back to my radio show, because of all people, there's a music festival that's going on here, and it's the Rock of the 70s Revisited Tour. And they keep shuffling the lineup on this thing, but one of the guys who's going to be here will be my guest on our Music Monday discussion tomorrow, Pat Travers. And there's a name you probably haven't thought of in a good long period of time.
Pat Travers Band, Jesus.
Yes, and they're still out there doing it. And, you know, he's, again, the conversation has already been done. It's already in the can and waiting to air tomorrow. But a tremendously nice guy, had some great stories to tell. And, you know, I remember my sister going to a concert when she was probably 14 or 15, which would have meant I was like 10 or 11. And she went to see Pat Travers and I'm sure 38 Special and a bunch of other bands at a concert at Tampa Hi-Li. And she said, you know, when he came out, even though he opened that show, when he did Boom Boom Out Go the Lights, it was, I mean, the whole place just erupted. And that's not even his song, by the way, but still, just, it became a sort of a signature version of it. And the other bands that are on the bill are April Wine and The Babies, without, obviously, their famous lead singer, Savoy Brown and Pat Travers headlining the show, which is really kind of a cool lineup. So I figured where we would go with the In Our Heads thing this week is back to not necessarily the one-hit wonders, although we did have One Hit Wonder Day a week ago, but the bands that found themselves almost there. You know what I mean? The sort of forgotten treasures that are still out there that you think of when you're going through, going, you know what? I've heard every song on my playlist 400 times. There's got to be more out there that I'm forgetting. Who do you go back to?
This may be a stretch, so I want to start it off by saying that, now that you've made this the topic. I want to say the Hollies.
Yeah?
The Hollies really get either left behind or short shrifted. You know, they're not looked upon with the same kind of rapture and accolades and outward respect that the Beatles, the Who, and the Kinks, even the Yardbirds now, more so than they used to, these bands all get. The Hollies always seem to be forgotten in the shuffle. They almost seem like the asterisk in the Graham Nash tale, you know?
Right. And I think that may be part of the reason why, is because they didn't have a consistent lead singer from one end to the other.
The thing is, the Hollies were such a powerful, solid entity unto themselves, up to the point where Graham Nash left. And even though they changed course, it unfortunately did get watered down. They put out some really good records. I mean, you know, their last big hit is one of my favorite songs of all time, The Air That I Breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Which is such a, it's a magnificent piece of work. But, you know, they did an album called Moving Finger that was, and this is in the post-Graham Nash era, that completely got overlooked, and it's a fine piece of work, but because they became a forgotten commodity, really, after his departure, you know, nobody really paid that much attention to it.
Yeah. You know, in addition to that, because you and I are both big fans of the Knack, who certainly would slide right in there with all of these other bands that we've been mentioning. However, the one that I tend to forget until it's time that it comes back, and I had another one that happened today, as a matter of fact, because I was out doing some shopping, and Greg Kinn kept popping up time and time again. But the one that I always tend to forget about until I go back to the music, I'll hear one song, and I'll go, oh, yeah, you know, Nick Lowe was really solid, and go back and start listening to Nick Lowe again, and I'll just go down a rabbit hole for weeks.
I can go through everything from Jesus of Cool / Pure Pop for Now People up to Cowboy Outfit.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's pretty much prime Nick Lowe.
Definitely.
Because, you know? I think one of my favorites was, again, from that later period, was Half a Boy and Half a Man. It's hysterical as it's brilliant. But, I mean, we also, you know, I'm a little bit more biased, so it's a little bit sketchy for me, because in the earliest days of 2 Minutes Hate, we used to cover various Nick Lowe tracks, usually things like Mary Provost or what do you call it, So It Goes, and I always like Man of a Fool. The thing is, it's hard for me to try and pinpoint, because I'm sure they're staring me in the face.
But you tend to forget about them.
I tend to forget. It's true. I mean, I'm trying to think of the new wave era, because you brought up the Knack, but the Knack always fall into the one hit wonders, even though they're not right. Because certainly Round Trip was criminally overlooked, and that's a really good album.
Mm-hmm.
The third album by the original Knack lineup in 1981. You know, I hate to say it, but there's a caveat to this, of course. When you talk about the punk and new wave legends, and you talk about, you know, the cornerstone bands or albums, you always hear the same names over and over again. The Sex Pistols and The Clash, who I'm not even going to get into it.
Yep.
The Jam, The Buzzcocks, right? but not often enough the Damned always seem to get left behind.
True.
Damned were the first, by the way, of the British punk bands. You know, they're the first ones to put out a single, first ones to put out an album, first to tour the United States, first to break up, first to get back together again. I don't know if it's because people looked upon them as a comedy band or a novelty act or what it was, or with the fact that they were incredibly skilled musicians. They weren't these, you know, I just picked up a guitar for the first time kind of oafs. The Damned had one of the greatest solid catalogs and consistent outputs from Damn, 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 the first album, all the way through to, hell, I'd go as far as to say Phantasmagoria in 1985, by which time they'd gone through so many lineup changes and so many permutations. But the consistency and the quality of their music can never, ever be called to question because they've always been that good.
Yeah.
I mean that good. Now, I'll give you one because they never had a hit. Utopia.
All right.
The band that always gets overlooked. And mind you, I'm still pissed off at Todd Rundgren. I told you, I'm holding a grudge. But Utopia, even though they started out as kind of a, you know, an underground prog band or a prog project for Todd Rundgren, you know, they developed into a really good, solid band by the end of the 70s.
Yeah.
And they put out a string of things from about 78 to 82, 83. They were fantastic. They never get talked about. They always get left behind. And only just recently did Todd Rundgren, in fact, resurrect Utopia.
Right. Well, and how many times do you hear, you know, again, it's something that's got a couple of connections back to the ones we've been talking about, but you mentioned the fact that the Knack wrongfully get lumped into that one-hit wonder category. Thin Lizzy also never gets credit for anything but one song.
What about Traffic? Because Traffic doesn't get talked about as much as Wynwood does, and of course, you know, for some reason, they always equate Wynwood with Clapton because of Blind Faith, and so Clapton gets brought into the conversation. But Traffic is a fucking phenomenal band.
Yeah, they are. And you know, and again, even in their own catalog, I think the John Barleycorn album was the one that I think is musically the most interesting to me personally. And yet, that's the one that even fans of theirs are like, eh.
It's funny because most people I know love... They love two albums in particular, Barleycorn or Low Spark of High
Hip. Right, yep.
For me, it's always been and will always be Mr. Fantasy / Heaven Is In Your Mind if you have the original first pressing of the American release.
Right.
Because that's the album that A, introduced the band, B, people forget that it was a four-piece band that had Dave Mason. Dave Mason wrote the second single, Hole in My Shoe, which is just... If anybody could possibly at that moment give Syd Barrett a run for his money, it could have been Dave Mason. I won't feel a feel that it just wasn't real with 100 tin soldiers which stood at my shoulder. And all the time you lost, the hole in my shoe which was letting in water.
Yeah, whatever happened to that guy?
Yeah, right. But I mean, the first album in the United States, Heaven Is In Your Mind, then quickly retitled Mr. Fantasy, starts off with The Magnificent Paper Sun.
Right.
I mean, for God's sakes. But this album has on it things like, obviously, Dear Mr. Fantasy, Heaven Is In Your Mind, Berkshire Poppies, No Face, No Number, No Name. I mean, it's just a fucking amazing album.
Yep.
Period. You know?
Great place to end it up. Well, it's more great entries as always. And again, I never tell Rob what we're doing with these before we get there. And sometimes even I don't know until halfway through through our talks. So
the beauty of this, folks, is that John and I are so simpatico with one another, as many of you have pointed out, and I appreciate that kind of sentimentality. Because the folks who are kind enough to write in always say, what I love listening to the show for is the fact that you two are so in sync with each other.
Well, thank you. That's good to hear. So we'll take anybody listening to this program for any reason whatsoever. So, yeah, leave comments, man. Do that thing and write us and let us know what you're thinking.
It's not feeding our egos. It's just it's nice to hear because it just tells us, yep, we're on the right track and we're doing something that people enjoy. And that's what we want.
And we enjoy it too. Make no mistake about that. So Rob will do it again next week. Sound good?
I guess so.
All right, man. Well, take care of your own self, and I will see you then.
All right, my brother. Be well and have a great week.